Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and our guests today, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne Brody. Jill is an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW. Lori, a physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW-Madison. And maybe you enjoy staying active over the winter. How do you stay warm and safe when you're exercising in the cold? What other physical therapy questions do you have? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. We would love to hear from you. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Lori Tyne Brody, same to you.
Hey, it's awesome to be here, and it's not very cold today. So people might say, oh, cold weather? Where's that?
Right, and the sun is out, which always makes a huge difference.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, the sun, it was a beautiful morning, at least in southern Wisconsin.
It was.
Up at dawn.
Mm-hmm. Did you go out for your walk today?
Did a little jog and
walk.
And
how did you dress for that today, Larry?
I dressed the way I actually bought a new pair of shoes for winter
that really?
Are winter tennis shoes, but they're winter tennis shoes.
Uh huh. And what's winter about them?
The sole's a little thicker. The insulation is a little bit
nice. Okay. Good.
Heavier. So. And then my Wisconsin Public Radio knit cap.
Of course.
And a light jacket.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm.
That's probably all you needed this morning. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yep, it was great. And the wonderful pink sky.
Yeah, it was awesome. Yes.
But so, what about this business of getting ready in the morning? I just got up.
Yeah, I know. Well, the conventional wisdom is layers. And so you kind of go, yeah, well, what does that mean? So, I thought yesterday was a good example. I went out for a run. And when I went out, I was into a fairly stiff and very cold headwind. So on the way out, I needed, I had on obviously my winter running tights and a hoodie that's sort of thermal and wicks moisture with a light jacket. And then I have two layers of gloves. Mm-hmm. So on the way out, I needed I wear a headband, a knit headband to keep my ears warm. I put my hood up. And I have two layers of gloves on the way out. But when I turned around on the way back, I took my hood off and I let the heat escape the top of my head, though mm-hmm. I still had a headband on to keep my ears warm. And I took off my outer layer of gloves. So then I just had on a thin pair of gloves to protect my skin, but I didn't need the heat. So when you think about going out, you need to take into consideration the wind primarily in the winter, just the air temperature.
It was windy. I went yesterday, too. And it was very, very windy.
Right. Yeah. Well, and as fast as Lori runs, it doesn't really matter if there's wind or not because she's going so fast that it's it always plays a factor.
Don't
in Lori's
say that.
Run.
No, I'm doing the Burby Derby on Thursday with Sports Medicine has a team going, so go UW Sports Medicine. So I'll be out there and. I consider myself to be a shuffler,
good
not
for you.
Really a runner. I do it just to get outside.
Just outside.
And it's great. And it's so great to get out and get in that fresh air. And I think if you're dressed appropriately, you'll embrace it much more and you'll have a much better attitude about it. And the layering is oh so important. And, layers that have pockets on them. So if you have to take off those gloves or somewhere to stash them, all of those things I think are important considerations. The other thing is footwear. Did you change your socks at all? Did you wear thicker socks?
Yeah, usually I wear two layers of socks. So I have a very thin wool sock and than just my regular sock, but ones that are higher.
Yeah.
In the summer, I wear low-cut socks, but now I wear a higher sock.
Right. And wool is really nice, or something with wool in it on your feet is really nice. And then staying dry is essential.
Last winter, there was one big snowstorm last winter, and it happened overnight. And I got up in the morning, and there's about 6 inches of snow on the ground, and it's snowing hard. And I went out anyway. And I'm
good for you.
The only one out there. And I'm thinking, now what, you idiot? If you fall down,
right? Well, there's always that risk too. And so, wearing things like yak tracks or different things on your boots are very important to prevent yourself from slipping and falling.
Yeah, and I have yak tracks, and the thing to remember about them is on snow, they'll be really good. On bare pavement, they're slipperier than not having them on.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a real, you really need to know the terrain you're going to be on. If you're running on sidewalks where some are clear and some are snowy, it's kind of a double-edged sword.
Right, it's dicey.
I never wear them. Because I'm on a sidewalk or on the street. Although I could have used them that day for sure.
Right, exactly.
It was
exactly.
a slog, and it really was not a jog. It was a walk and try and get through the
the
3 miles.
Yeah, and snowshoes are fabulous.
Right.
If you like to snowshoe, that's just a great winter activity to get out. Even you don't have to run, but just walking and stomping through the snow is so great.
And it requires no skill.
Yeah.
It's a nice thing.
Yeah,
you literally put on snowshoes and you can go
walk.
With or without poles.
Right.
So it's,
I've got
it's
a pair, and I like using them. But I never use them on the morning jog. Always when you're in a park somewhere.
Right, exactly.
And do you ever, here's what I do when I warm up. I get out and I start walking. I'll walk about 6 blocks, and then I might start to jog.
Yeah.
Well, you want to do some sort of warm-up. You don't just want to go out in that cold weather without some good circulation. So some people will do a dynamic warm-up in their garage, you know, where you're not at risk for falling, and do some calisthenic-type movements and get their blood flowing a little bit, or even a little bit of jogging in place before they head out into the cold. You definitely don't just want to hit the cold weather without being warmed up at all.
Right, and the nice thing about warming up in your house is you get warm and you go, oh, man, I'm really hot, and you go outside, and then it feels good, you know, as compared to going outside cold.
Right.
You step outside, you go, oh, man, it's really cold, I'm going back in.
Right, exactly.
I have to admit that when I get back in the morning, I usually, because it's 6:30 in the morning, I usually go straight upstairs and take my hot shower. And I don't stretch or do any exercising after the fact.
It's probably good to do some after you're out of the shower. I mean, most people do the first thing they want to do when they get in and they're sweaty and things like that is take a shower. And as long as you do some sort of stretching at some point, I think it's a good idea.
It's a good idea, but I never do.
Oh, I know.
Just for those people out there going, oh, God, if I have to stretch, I'm not going to go.
Right,
so,
exactly.
Yeah, maybe you can do a little stretching in the shower. Just reach overhead, stretch your calves.
What about this? What about it is icy or I don't want to go out, so mm-hmm. I want to do something inside, and mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of space.
Mm-hmm. There are great videos that you can find online, mm-hmm. you know, anything you want to do. There are videos online, or the public library has videos. You can get VCR tapes, or used to be able to get VCR tapes of 20 different kinds of yoga that you could do at home in a not very big space.
Right. The other thing is, if your garage is high enough, jumping rope is a great, it can be a steady state motion, or it can be an interval type thing, a little circuit. I have a neighbor who is probably in his early 60s, and he does a loop around our neighborhood. It's a mile around our neighborhood, and every 3 blocks he stops and he does some static jump roping. So there's no reason you couldn't do something like that in your garage if you have enough headspace and your garage is clear enough. Jumping rope's a great mm-hmm. kind of cardiovascular activity that you can do almost anywhere.
Well, we have callers online. By the way, there's still an open line. You can get on at 1-800-642-1234. Let's take a call. Annie in La Crosse has something for us. Hi, Annie.
Hi. Say, I use a hula hoop. I have one of those large, weighted, cloth-covered hula hoops, and that helps inside, too.
That's a great idea.
I'd love a video of that.
Yeah.
I also snowshoe with a bunch of ladies. We call ourselves the Jabberwockers, and
nice.
We walk and we jabber, and we do it year-round. Anyway, my question is there anything that physical therapy can do to alleviate the symptoms of edema caused by lymph nodes being removed because of cancer?
Yeah, so you're talking about lymphedema. Yes, and absolutely there are physical therapists as well as occupational therapists who specialize in lymphedema. And so they know specific mobility and mobilization and massage techniques to help manage that. And they can also fit you for a custom compression garment. So right. Up by La Crosse, there should easily be a therapist that specializes in lymphedema. If you call the local clinic, they should be able to help you with that. And it's oftentimes PT, but there are some occasional occupational therapists that do specialize in lymphedema management as
there,
well.
There and there are certifications in it. So it's not just, oh, I enjoy treating lymphedema, but you can become certified as a lymphedema specialist.
Okay, yes. I'll have to call my Mayo.
Yeah.
Yep, thank you very much.
You bet.
Thanks very much. What is edema, by the way? Is it...
Edema is swelling that's not specific to a joint. So it can just be kind of like that is just generalized in your body.
Mm-hmm. The most common sites are in your arm after lymph node removal, usually for breast cancer. It's also common in the legs and ankles in people who have poor circulation or who have congestive heart failure. Those people will have generalized edema in their legs. You can, if you push your finger in them, it'll, instead of it rebounding, it'll stay kind of pitted. It's called pitting edema. So those people are usually treated with diuretics, compression stockings, as well as lifestyle management of elevating their legs every day. But the key is to understand why you have the edema and make sure that cause gets treated.
Okay.
Right, exactly.
Jim in Osceola, your turn now. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering what your guest's latest views on plantar fasciitis is. It seems like if you talk to 100 people,
you get a lot of different
100 different cures.
That is very,
I had it in one foot, and it took 2 years to go away without much help with just Walmart inserts. Now I've got in the other foot, and I've got super feet inserts.
Okay.
With Schuler shoes. Tennis shoes, but that's all I'm doing.
All right. Well, yeah, the orthopedic section of the APTA just revised their clinical practice guidelines on plantar fasciitis. So, frankly, they haven't changed a whole lot since the last time, except they found more evidence for certain interventions like night splints. Mm-hmm. So night splints are usually my go-to intervention for this, particularly longstanding plantar fasciitis. And it's funny, I just saw somebody this morning who has this issue when we discussed the night splint, but also this person also was using super feet, but they hurt her heels. And so I suggested a taping technique instead. So if you can't tolerate orthotics in your shoes, sometimes a taping technique can help, as well as the plantar fascia stretching, tennis ball rolling, et cetera.
And then looking farther up the chain is always, when somebody gets something on one side and not the other, you always wonder why. So somebody loading more on one side, do they walk heavier on that side? Do they always, when they do a certain activity, lead with that foot, or do they run on a road with an embankment or a cant? And so all of those things kind of help us diagnose if there's something up the chain we need to look for, whether it's some weakness in the gluteus medius muscle, some hamstring inflexibility, things like that. So unfortunately, there isn't a lot of, like Lori said, change in how we manage plantar fasciitis, although I think stepping back and looking at the big picture and looking farther up the chain is something we're getting much better at.
Sounds like Jim might benefit, though, from a night splint?
Sure, absolutely.
Are those prescription?
No. You can get lots of different styles or types. There's one called Strasburg socks, which are okay. They're not my favorite because they put your great toe in a whole bunch of extension.
And I think the clinical practice guidelines this time agreed with my own personal opinion, which is always nice when that works, that the anterior splint, splint that goes on the front of your ankle.
Dorsal splint.
It's called the dorsal night splint, is more comfortable than the one that goes behind your ankle. So if you imagine a splint that goes down the back of your leg and underneath your foot, not as comfortable as one that goes over the top of your shin and the top of your foot. It's a lot more comfortable. So looking for a dorsal night splint is probably better. You can probably get one for $30, $35
right,
online.
If you look on Amazon or something like that and Google dorsal splint for plantar fasciitis or something like that. And they come in sizes kind of based on your shoe size, small, medium, large. Mm-hmm. They work great.
So somebody's already wondering about what are you taping?
Well, if you're taping the undersurface of your foot, you're taping the arch of your foot. So if you look online, if you just Google plantar fascia taping. They'll show you what's called a low dye taping technique.
And it's not Lodi, Wisconsin.
Right.
It's Lowdye.
That being said, my favorite Lodi taping technique is a single piece of duct tape. So one piece of duct tape from the bottom outside of your foot, underneath your fourth and fifth toes, down around your heel, and up across to your first and second metatarsal heads. Single piece of duct tape seems to work really well.
Uh-huh. And now duct tape, which didn't happen when Lori was lecturing and she had to wear dress heels. You could see her duct tape. Now duct tape comes in beige.
Yeah, so there you go.
You can use duct tape.
Jim, thanks a lot for calling. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer here on the Ideas Network. Talking all kinds of physical therapy issues today. We started by talking about exercising in the cold. We can still talk about that, but take your PT question as well, no matter what it might be, at 1-800-642-1234. Ellen in Madison, thank you for joining us. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Hey, I just wanted to give you some advice on going outside in the cold and the ice. I live in Alaska most of the year, and I come here sporadically for a couple of months. I'm here right now until the end of December. But the best shoes you can have for outside in the ice are called Ice Bugs. And you can buy them at probably, I haven't seen them around here, but up in Alaska you can get them all over. They have titanium studs on the bottom. And they are, everybody has them up there, and they are the best shoes to go outside in. And they sell running shoes, and they sell hiking boots, and I think they're made in Iceland. But they are just wonderful, and I swear by them. I wear them all the time. Of course, I didn't bring them to Madison because I thought it was going to be warmer here.
Uh-huh. Right, exactly. So you have different shoes for different activities, like you have walking shoes and then regular just out and about town shoes.
Right, and then the Ice Bugs are, you can't take the studs off.
Right,
but if
right.
you're going to go out in the ice and snow, like I would wear them to work, and then I'd take them off, and then I'd put them back on. But when I would walk every night in the worst weather in Ice Bugs, and never fell, never slipped. They are wonderful.
And so they're good on ice as well, because I've noticed with the Yak Tracks that they're good on snow and packed snow, but ice isn't quite as good. They don't slide on
right.
ice.
Right. Yeah, because they have almost like a hexagonal stud on the bottom, and
right.
there's a number of them, and then it's rubberized on the bottom as well.
Okay.
And they're also very comfortable shoes. They're just, I love them.
Okay.
And
yeah.
and is it okay, like one of the things Lori had said earlier is that when you have to transition from snow to concrete, they're yucky. How are these if you have to walk on concrete a bit?
They last.
They do.
I asked about that when I bought them, and they actually last for at least 7 years.
Wow.
They don't break down. And I went hiking in September up there way before the snow, and I was on concrete and trails, and they were great, too. They're good for going on any trail.
Hmm. Yeah. Well,
awesome.
Thanks, Ellen.
Those look great. We've been looking at those online.
We just went online
really
to
nice.
Look.
Yep, exactly. Awesome. Thank you, Ellen, for sharing that.
Put it on
that.
Our Christmas list.
Exactly.
That's a great
Wait, do you
thing.
Have my name this year?
I'm probably going to now.
Oh, thank you again.
I bet that price is going up. That price point on our gifts is going up right now, too, isn't it?
Well, the one I've got up right now is like 50 bucks.
Yeah, that's not bad at all.
That's not, yep. I wonder how warm they are.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we looked at them here. They ranged anywhere from $39 to $180.
Yeah.
You know, like most things.
Right.
You can get a running shoe in that same range as well. So
exactly. And I also looked it up on Amazon while we had our break, Larry, on the dorsal night splint.
Yeah.
And they range anywhere from $22 to $57. So, but that dorsal splint you can get as low as like $24.99.
Okay.
Here's one for $14.99, but I'd probably go with like a $24.99 one or so. It looks a little bit more stable.
Okay.
So there you go.
Helen in Madison, your turn.
Yes. This is Helen calling. I'm an elderly person. I'm 97. And I've had two sessions of the physical therapy this year, and the problem is in the muscles in my hip. When I step, I put a lot of, there's pain when I put any weight on it, but the exercises have helped them tremendously. My question now is, When I walk outside, I use a walker. In the house, I depend on the cane. Is there some exercise that could get me away from using that cane all the time?
Well, the idea is to strengthen your hips. So there are a couple issues in terms of using the cane. One is your strength and your ability to move around your house independently. And the second piece of it is your balance.
Right.
So the question is, why do you need the cane? And the strength and the balance can be intertwined, but they can also be separate issues. So it may be that you need more strength so that if you lose your balance, you're strong enough to catch yourself. It could also be that you need work on balance training and those kinds of exercises, which are different than strengthening exercises. They're working on destabilizing you and teaching you how to restabilize yourself and work on your balance. So it may be that you need balance exercises in addition to the strengthening you were given.
And the other thing is, I think Lori kind of hit it on the head, is we would never want to take your cane away from you or if you're at risk of a fall. So we the last thing we want you to do at the beautiful age of 97 is sustain a fall.
Right.
So you have to kind of consider the cost-benefit ratio of it. And I know sometimes using a cane is inconvenient, but if that's going to help you stay in your house longer, live longer, that's going to be
right.
a strategy to use. So it's a great question for the physical therapist you're seeing.
It is. And keep in mind that if you have a cane, it can only offload about 20% of your body weight. So, you know, for the most part, if you're weak, a cane doesn't help all that much. But what it does is it gives you a third point of balance. So it helps with your balance probably a little bit more than it helps with strength or weakness.
Yeah.
So I would talk to your physical therapist about the balance piece of cane use.
And there are some physical therapists who also are involved in yoga. And for balance, I just did a show on yoga last week.
I heard that show. That was a very good show.
And Helen's in Madison, mm-hmm. and so there are yoga classes for people, for elderly people.
Right,
and
chair yoga.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And there is the UW did some research on this, and there's actually, they were able to study a lot of elderly people and the number of falls that were taken following that drop precipitously, mm-hmm. in fact, significant drop in falls.
And the UW also puts on a program called Stepping On, which is a short, maybe 6 or 8 class session to work on preventing falls. It's a series of exercises as well as classroom instruction on different aspects of falling and how to prevent falls. So that's another nice service that UW offers.
Yeah.
Right. Lots of options.
Thank you very much for calling, Helen.
That's a great question,
Helen. Scott in Norway, Michigan, your turn. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I wanted to talk about IT band syndrome.
Okay.
Iliotibial band syndrome.
Yep.
I have been to the orthopedist. She's given me exercises to do, and I do them, and it hurts like a bugger.
Where does it hurt? Or is it more manifesting at your knee or at your hip? Or tell us about that.
Well, I also have bursitis in the greater trochanter.
Oh, well, that's
those two things go
together.
That's related. Yeah.
That's related.
Yeah. Totally.
So,
did you get these?
It starts in the hip, but you know what it does. It goes all the way down the
right.
Yes, we
okay.
do.
Middle of the calf.
Okay. So, what have you done to treat it so far?
I do the exercises, and I take naproxen sodium twice a day.
Okay. So you're stretching?
I'm stretching. I do the exercises for both the iliotibial band syndrome and for the hip bursa.
So did you say a physician gave you these exercises?
Yes.
Okay. So here's what I think we need to do. I think it would be very helpful for you to see a physical therapist because there are some just great kind of general exercises we give people, but I think you need a better biomechanical assessment from a physical therapist who would be able to do that. So it may be that you have a little bit of a drop in your pelvis that's causing that load on that. They may need to look at your back a little bit. So I think you've tried kind of the general kind of garden variety exercises that can be issued or recommended to somebody once they have IT band syndrome, but I think you need to go to the next level.
Right, exactly. So if you're not getting better with the standard exercises that you can find online, then you need a better analysis of why you're not responding to this. So Jill's absolutely right. And a lot of times what I see is they'll give them like rolling. They'll mm-hmm. roll on your IT band. Well, maybe what you need to do is get that little plunger from the hardware store and distract, go the other direction,
right.
Which is why you need someone to take a little bit closer look at this and figure out precisely what the right group of exercises
right.
is for you.
And I've seen people roll over their bursa, which causes irritates the bursitis. So it may be helpful to have somebody look at how you do your exercises and make sure that the ones you're doing are appropriate and that you're doing them correctly.
Yep.
Good luck. Awesome. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Yep. Great question.
Sue in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I think it's arthritis in my second thumb joint, both hands.
Your carpal metacarpal mm-hmm. joint, yes.
Yep.
Okay. Are there any simple exercises I could do to loosen it up? It does make an opposable thumb sort of.
Yes, sure. Come and wash dishes at my house on Thanksgiving.
No, it's
the dishwasher, huh?
The carpal metacarpal joint of the thumb, as you're talking about, is a very kind of a hot spot for arthritis, especially in women. It has to move in multiple joints. Our thumb is 70% of our hand function, and so we rely on it very, very heavily. So she had mentioned that it's hard to oppose. That means taking your thumb and your pinky together, which is a huge part of hand function.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a common place to get arthritis. And Lori did say, I mean, she was kind of being sarcastic and funny, but actually mobility in warmth, in warm water or something like that is actually a really good strategy.
You said something.
Sadly, mm-hmm. doing dishes is
doing dishes is actually a good thing because you move your hand around in a lot of different ways in a warm, supportive environment without a lot of resistance. Squeezing a sponge in warm water. Those are simple things, as well as going the other direction. Like if you put a rubber band around your finger, your thumb, and your first finger and pull it apart to work the muscles the other direction is good. But the idea is they need to be pain-free. You can't do them to the point of pain because you're aggravating the joint. So ideally, you want to strengthen the muscles around it. You also want to strengthen farther up the kinetic chain, your elbow and shoulder, so that they can position your arm appropriately and they can take some of the load off of your hand.
Isn't there something like a hot wax that you
can use? Paraffin wax.
Paraffin wax.
Those are lovely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are nice. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's warmth. You could also consider seeing a hand specialist at this point because they make splints mm-hmm. for that thumb joint because it is involved so frequently, and you might see somebody for a couple visits and see if there's a splint that you could wear for certain activities, as well as a tool modification for scissors, knives, gardening tools, whatever. They can talk to you about the kind of tool grip that you need or point you in the direction of those to decrease the stress on your thumb.
Right, and that would be a certified hand therapist.
Yep.
And you're in the Milwaukee area. There's, I'm sure, many of those around there, and it could be either a physical therapist or an occupational therapist that can be a certified hand therapist. So I think Lori's idea of having a couple visits with somebody would be good to get you on the right path.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Kathleen on Facebook wonders if you could talk about osteoporosis of the spine in women. She knows that weight-bearing exercise is important. What do you think of weight vests for walking or indoor use?
You know, I would not recommend that. I think we need to load our bones, which is really good. So I think walking is really good. If I wanted to load the thoracic spine more, I would do some resistance training.
Yeah, you don't want to add a compressive load.
Right.
So what you're doing, if you add the weighted vest, is you're increasing the compressive force on the spine. So I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't wear a weighted vest.
Make it worse.
It very well potentially could make it worse.
Yeah, you want to strengthen the muscles in the thoracic spine, and wearing a weighted vest won't do that.
Yeah, and if that's an issue for Kathleen, see a physical therapist and get instructed in not only the right exercises, but how to do them. So back to the Scott's question on the iliotibial band, it's not just do this exercise or don't do this exercise, but how you do it becomes really important so that you're not increasing the compressive forces in your spine.
Debbie in Green Bay, on to you now. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been a walker my entire life, and periodically I've had lower back pain, and it will come and go and come and go, and then recently it's been more severe. So they sent me to a physical therapist, and then finally they did an MRI, and they found that I have two bulging discs on the last two lumbar vertebrae. So I went back to the physical therapist, and I asked if there was a different set of exercises we could try or something else to help strengthen that area or, you know, maybe relieve some of the pain. And he said, not really with what he had already given me. And I was just wondering, are there physical therapy exercises or physical therapists that specialize with people with lower back pain that could maybe help me?
Well, that's a really good question. And my best guess is before you saw the therapist before you had your MRI, and they were probably treating you as if you did have disc or nerve root irritation, because it's pretty easy to kind of tease through that without an MRI. So the MRI probably confirmed the hunch.
Right.
So my guess is he was treating you how you were manifesting in the first place. But having said that, Lori's shaking her head, wants to interrupt me.
I was just waiting till you were done.
I'm done.
Jeez. So to your specific question, yes, there are people who specialize at PTs who specialize it. For example, I work at a spine clinic. There are people who are orthopedic clinical specialists who tend to specialize a lot in spine. But I totally agree with Jill. When the physical therapist does their initial evaluation, they look for a cluster of signs and symptoms that suggest that this is facet disease, this is an osteoporotic fracture, this is spinal stenosis, this is a disc. So my guess is the PT's hunch was that you had disc herniations, and that's how you were being treated. So the MRI just confirmed that PT's hunch, and the idea is to continue with the conservative management at this point. So if you're not getting better, certainly, you know, go back and let your PT know, this isn't working, I'm not getting better, we need to shift directions.
Right. Try plan B, approach it a little bit differently, things like that.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks for calling, Deb. Kay in Prairie du Sac, it's your turn. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I'd like some explanation so I can kind of understand the problems that my brother-in-law has. He has ankylosing spondylitis, and so he's had numerous joint replacements. Now, about 10 years ago, he had a hip revision, and now after this long length of time, he has a seroma that continues to drain. It's probably been 3 to 4 weeks now. They've put a drain tube in, and the doctor takes about 40 cc's out like every other day. And why does something like this develop so much later?
That's a great question. Those are different than plain old hematomas, which is a bit much more blood cell. I don't know if seromas are more common in people with ankylosing spondylitis or not.
I don't think
they'd be correlated.
I don't know that I've seen anybody with a seroma.
I haven't either, especially with that much fluid.
Exactly. That's a lot of fluid. Unfortunately, I don't think I can answer that question. I would refer you back to your brother-in-law's physician. How long ago was this surgery?
This revision was 10 years ago.
And it's still draining fluid?
It just started.
It just started.
Out of the blue about 3 weeks ago.
Well, wow. I don't know. I could theorize, but I could be completely wrong. So since it's really out of my wheelhouse, I'm going to keep my theories inside my head and not let them come out my mouth and have you have that conversation with his physician.
That's a tough one.
Right. Yeah. And there are certain things that will manifest many, many years after surgeries that we really don't know why, especially with total joints. But with his multiple comorbidities, that'd be something that you'd want to make sure is really carefully medically managed. And it sounds like he is. But I have no explanation for why it's happening.
Is that seroma, is that lymphatic fluid then that would be coming?
Well, it's clear fluid with a little bit of blood in it. I don't know that it's necessarily lymph, because it's joints.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Those are great questions that are probably much better managed by physicians.
And if you find an answer, you let us know.
Exactly.
Yeah, we'd love to.
Because now we're very
question.
Curious.
That's a great question.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Call next month.
Yeah.
You guys are back on December 18th. By that time, maybe.
Oh, fabulous.
Okay.
Jane in Mauston, your turn. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I have a question about a sore shoulder. I had a flu shot in October, and I was kind of surprised at how high she did it on my arm. And I've been having a sore shoulder ever since, kind of like bursitis symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be related, and how long would it last? Basically,
typical soreness that you see after you get some sort of flu shot or, you know, allergy shots or something like that doesn't normally last that
couple
long.
Days,
yeah,
usually.
A couple days.
Yeah, I've had, you know, and they never last. I mean, I'll be sore a little bit, but this is where there's the point I can even hardly move my shoulder joint.
Yeah.
I do yoga every day, and I had to really modify what I can do now.
Is it getting any better?
Well, no. I mean, it was really bad the first 4 or 5 days. And and now it's just been sore where I can't do the yoga like I would like to do. But then it falls asleep, too. And, I mean, I can't sleep on it.
Yeah. You know what? You need to go see somebody and have this looked at. The two could simply be a coincidence, or it may be
that
getting the shot in that arm, if they hit a little superficial nerve or something, could have stirred things up, and you changed how you moved, and next thing you know, it's your cervical spine. So,
well, and the other thing is, I appreciate that you're still doing your yoga, which is wonderful, but I hear you say that you're modifying activity, and the last thing we want you to do is end up with a frozen shoulder because of lack of motion.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So we want to nip this in the bud. So I agree with Lori. It's a little out of what I would expect the normal standard deviation for when people get a little bit of soreness from a flu shot.
Right.
Well, I read something about when they put the shot too high, the injection, it could go into your joint.
Well,
that'd be a pretty long shot because that'd have to be a long.
Right. Okay. And the bursa sits up on top of your shoulder. So
about where she did.
You'd be hard pressed to get it in the bursa unless your bursa was already inflamed and swollen.
Right.
Yeah. But I would get in and see somebody because you need to move on this.
Yeah, exactly.
Good luck, Jane. Thank you so much for calling. Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guests. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Tomorrow at 11, we'll talk about laser eye surgery with our guests, so I hope you'll join us for that. Right now, taking your questions about physical therapy with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori, athletic trainer at UW's Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. David in Slinger up next with a question. Let's go there. Hi, David. Thank you for calling.
Sure. More as a comment. As a family doc of 20, 30 years, I just wanted to comment how wonderful it is to see the change from looking at one joint to the whole system. I mean, it used to be that when somebody came in with an ankle or a thumb problem or whatever it was, that's all we dealt with, and we didn't look up the chain, as you mentioned. And it only makes sense that the ankle bone's connected to the knee bone's connected to the hip bone and the backbone. And I just wanted to say it's so good to hear you guys talk like that.
Thank you so much, and thanks for the call. And you know, we understand that in the high pressure environment now, and primary care and elsewhere, that, you know, you come in with an ankle sprain, it's tough to take the time to look and see, well, you know, what does it look like here? What does it look like there? What does a hip look like? And so physical therapists sort of feel uniquely qualified to take that step back and say, okay, this person came in with ankle pain. Let's take a look, you know, up and down the chain and see what's going on so we can get to the root cause of the problem. And sometimes it is what it is. You know, when you hear hoofbeats, it's a horse.
Right.
But other times it is a zebra. And so fortunately, we still, hopefully, physical therapists have the time to do that and take that look. But we understand that that's not always the case in other high-pressure environments.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But yeah, it
thank
is.
You, David. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah.
Annette in Green Bay, we turn to you next. Hi, Annette.
Hi, Larry. Great program, like always.
Thank you.
I have a question about spinal stenosis. You mentioned it a little while ago with somebody else, and I have apparently a pinched nerve. An MRI was done, and what my symptoms are that my left leg is sore and aching, and especially at night, and my hip hurts. When I walk on it quite a bit, then it feels better. But at night, without any activity, sometimes it just aches and throbs. And they said something about now maybe talking to a spinal surgeon. And I was thinking physical therapy. I would be more interested in that. Can a physical therapist help with a pinched nerve? And
absolutely, yes. I think that's a great strategy for you. It sounds like you have figured out some ways to manage it on your own, but depending on exactly what is irritating the nerve, physical therapists could put you in kind of a directional preference that would unload that nerve as much as possible. It may be just changing your position of your pelvis as you're sitting or walking, something like that to kind of offload it. So I would definitely try conservative therapy first before you go down the path of surgery, because you're talking about a big surgery.
Right.
So I would absolutely try that first. And it sounds like you have a really good handle on your symptoms historically. So that's very helpful when you go in to see a physical therapist for the first time to kind of know what things fire you up, what things bring down your symptoms. So I definitely think I'd start with PT.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't mention physical therapy at all. It's just I'm surprised, but I would rather do physical therapy than spinal surgery.
Absolutely. Yep. I would give it a try too.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, it's interesting. If you look across the country, there are areas where there's a much higher rate of spinal surgery.
By zip code.
Right. And it has to do, we don't know exactly what it has to do with, but sometimes it has to do with the training, where people come from a certain philosophy of training when they go through their residency or fellowship. And so they, you know, the way they think is, well, you do surgery. So it's always good to stop and step back and ask that question of, is that the right path for me?
Yeah, there we go. Thank you again, Annette.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Lane in Burlington, on to you now. Hi, Lane.
Hi, I was just wondering if your guests ever heard of stiff person syndrome. After a mirage of tests and just about driving ourselves crazy, we finally found out that my wife was diagnosed with stiff person syndrome.
Yeah, you know, it's great. I'm going to defer to Lori because she has actually seen a person with this.
Yeah.
So it's a very rare diagnosis, very unusual.
Right. It's a very rare autoimmune disease. It's a neurologic disease affecting the brain and nerves that causes basically your muscles to stiffen up.
Right.
And it can affect your legs. It causes muscle spasms. It can be triggered for any unknown reason, such as a loud noise or something like that. It can trigger these muscle spasms. In terms of treatment, I would certainly defer to the medical community for that. And from the physical therapy point of view, I've seen people in the pool as a way to exercise and help minimize the stiffness, just because it's easier to move in that unweighted environment. So what were some of your wife's symptoms, Lane?
Everything you're talking about. Basically, she gets up and she says it's like walking through concrete.
Yeah.
That's not set.
Yeah.
Very, very unstable. She has fallen a couple times. But it's just exactly, she's saying the noise bothers her, everything he said, yeah.
Yeah.
It was just driving us crazy not to know what it was. We thought
right.
it was MS or something like that.
Right.
The way she was
right.
walking.
Can
but
I?
We do understand that it's a very rare, like one in a million.
Right.
Talk about a zebra instead of a horse.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Can I ask how old she was when she first started getting symptoms and how long it was until you were given a diagnosis? Because I think that's one of the hardest parts is when this unknown, when people are trying to search for the diagnosis.
She did have something probably about 10 years ago that happened that they didn't know what it was. And this is just recently. This was just basically July 5th. She basically thought she was having a heart attack. Her whole right side of her body went numb.
Wow.
Oh, my.
Okay.
Yeah, well, one in a million is the incidence of it, or the prevalence, females more than males, generally age 30 to 60. But it's also been reported in children. So what are they talking about in terms of treatment?
We just got the diagnosis, so we're just in the middle of it.
Okay.
And unfortunately, she's not very keen to water. She doesn't swim.
Yeah. Water's not going to be the cure for that. Water's just going to be a place where hopefully she can move. I mean, the interventions are more muscle relaxants and medication-based. But she doesn't have to swim. If you can find a warm pool where she can walk and float and relax, it can maybe help relax some of the muscle spasms.
Yeah, we just moved, and I had a hot tub, and that
okay.
was awesome for her.
Yeah, okay. So something right. along that line, that'd be great.
Right, to offload her
yeah.
and not make her feel like she's always moving through concrete.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
exactly.
It is, everything triggers it, too, like you said, like noise, stress.
Mm-hmm.
Even a little stress will trigger, it's a neurological disease.
Right, and that's why they generally refer them for things like meditation and mindfulness classes to manage the stress, so that stress is not such a triggering factor for them.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine what the holidays, I'm sure this
oh,
upcoming
yeah.
holidays is huge
yeah.
because there's so much stress that goes with
right.
it, loud noises.
Right.
So,
right.
so but developing a lot of strategies to get through that will
right.
be helpful.
But having a diagnosis hopefully is stress reducing for her because at least she
right.
knows what it is and
right.
and you can start to manage it because you know what the diagnosis and prognosis are.
right.
I'm just worried about like the stairs, our bedrooms upstairs. We are
right.
setting up a Zen room. And our spare room to do meditation and yoga
yep.
and stuff.
That's wonderful.
Yep.
Those are all the right steps.
Yep, it seems like you have a plan in place and keep moving forward.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Lane. Very much appreciate your call. Stiff person syndrome.
Yeah.
It's the
right.
first time I've heard of it on
yeah.
this show and or anywhere
mm-hmm.
for that matter.
Well, one in a million.
Right,
so.
Yeah, I had heard
yeah.
of it, but never,
yeah.
like, it was in that category of I'll
yeah.
probably never hear or see of this in my lifetime.
Yeah.
So it's very, very rare.
Yeah.
Pat in Port Washington has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Pat.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I love your program, Larry.
Thank you.
I have been having pain in my hip for about 4 months when I walk. I walk quite a bit, and it kind of limited my walking a little bit. So I kind of asked my daughter, who is a Pilates instructor, and she thought possibly it was the piriformis muscle in my hip, and that is my went to my doctor for my annual, and she said, yeah, I think that's probably a good thing, you know, do these exercises, which what my daughter started me on. But the pain is now radiating kind of down the side and front of my leg, of my left leg, almost like a shin splint. But I'm doing the exercises religiously, but I'm wondering if there's anything else that I should be doing.
I think you should probably see a physical therapist. You know, your sciatic nerve runs very, very close to your piriformis muscle. And some
okay.
people, the sciatic nerve actually pierces through the piriformis muscle. So an irritated piriformis could cause sciatic type symptoms.
Okay.
But those would not wrap around to the front of your
nope.
leg. That sounds more lumbar spine-ish to
mm-hmm.
me.
Lumbar spine or hip impingement syndrome
yeah.
can also create symptoms in the front of your hip. Could also, yeah, lumbar spine, it could be your hip flexor, which attaches to the fourth and fifth vertebrae of your lumbar spine and runs in front of your hip as well. So All that being said, this is one of the more complicated areas of your body. So distinguishing primary hip from piriformis, from primary lumbar spine gets really difficult, which is why we don't say, oh, yeah, it's probably this or that, and try these exercises. Anytime you're in the lumbar spine hip devil's triangle, we say someone needs to evaluate you so that they can sort out each of those different things and get you on the right program. So the fact that you're not better with the piriformis program suggests it's not just primary piriformis.
Right. That okay. might be a contributing factor, but I would definitely see a physical therapist. Bring your exercises. This is what I've been doing based on your biomechanical evaluation. Should I continue with these? Should I change them, etc.? So I would definitely do that.
All right.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you.
Thanks. Yep.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Going back to exercising in the winter time, Bill sent a note and he says, I put a fluffy bed pillow in my backpack and this cushions me in case I slip backwards on the ice.
Huh. Well,
it's a way to be prepared.
It is one way to be prepared. You know, part of the issue is that if you fall, you're going to put out your hand to stop your fall. So you're going to end up with a Colles fracture, a rotator cuff tear, probably before that pillow hits the ground.
Right,
But it's a great idea. So
Yeah, most people end up falling and reaching out. And so it's usually an upper extremity injury that gets hurt. Or if you don't get your hands out in time, then you fall on your hip.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, maybe put a pillow underneath his tush.
There you go.
There you go. Kathy emailed to ask how... if you have some exercises that she could do to help osteoporosis in her arms.
It's a little unusual to have osteoporosis in your arms and not have it anywhere else. I would venture that if she has osteoporosis in her arms, she probably has it elsewhere.
Yeah, it's not a very common sight at all. I mean, they look at the distal radius for bone density as a measure of osteoporosis throughout your body, but it's not very common. So if she's having issues with that, I would see somebody because she's going to need a very specific program. So, you know, when she says arms, is that your humerus, your upper arm, your forearm? Is it your wrist? Is it your hand? You know, and none of those are common sites for osteoporosis.
Right.
So I would direct her to a medical professional to take a look.
Exactly.
Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guests today. They'll be with us up until 12:30. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. Then we will be back with Lori and Jill. Stay with us. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we are talking physical therapy issues today with Jill Tyne Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne Brody. Jill, Associate Professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy Program at the UW-Madison. Lori, Physical Therapist, Athletic Trainer at the UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And so they're back with us today to answer your questions about physical therapy. An open line or two at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And we're going to go right back to the phones. Tom in Brookfield's been waiting a bit. Tom, thanks for waiting.
Good morning. How is everyone?
Great.
Good. Awesome.
Good. I have a little comment with that lady that called in and had a problem with the hip and then it traveled down her leg into her shin.
Uh-huh.
I had the exact same thing. And the pain got so bad, I couldn't hardly just walk to the mailbox and back. I felt like somebody was pounding nails in my shin.
Wow.
So I had an MRI done. There was a little problems with my spine. And as far as like the discs and that, a little compression.
Mm-hmm.
And what I went in is the neurologist gave me an epidural, and that was 2 years ago, and been perfect since.
Great. Yep. So that's generally why they do the MRI. You know, the woman earlier had an MRI and found her bulging discs, et cetera. if your exam clearly shows that you have a disc injury, you don't necessarily need to have an MRI to confirm that. The reason you would get an MRI is so that they could decide if they're going to do another level of intervention, which is typically a lumbar epidural steroid injection. And they would want to see what they're looking at before they decide to just go stick a needle in your back.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're thinking about the next level of intervention, then maybe an MRI is warranted. And in Tom's case, it worked out really well. And that epidural can buy you a lot of time.
Right.
But the question is, why did you have those symptoms in the first place? And what are you doing to prevent it from coming back? So seeing a physical therapist for some strengthening exercises for your core, for your hips, some mobility exercises for your back, some instruction on how to move, sit, stand, lift, transition positions, etc., to decrease the stress on your back so it doesn't come back.
Right.
Yeah, great.
Exactly. But
thanks, Tom. Appreciate the call. Sue in Dubuque, Iowa is up next. Hi, Sue.
Hello. Good afternoon, I should say.
Yeah.
Same to you.
Thanks. I have a question about MCL root repair and total knee. I fell over my grandson and actually had cracked my kneecap, MCL root tear, and a Baker's cyst.
Oh.
And, I fell far and hard. And initially, the x-ray didn't show that it was a broken kneecap because it was just a hairline kind of crack.
Sure.
But I did suffer with it about 2 months before I had an MRI.
Oh.
And the ortho group said, well, we need to do an MCL root repair. So it was an unnecessary surgery, I believe, because it was 3 weeks of physical therapy and nothing was changing. And then I went to a different ortho group. And they said, well, clearly the MRI shows that you need a total knee. So then I had another ortho group. I had total knee surgery. And he said it would take about 2 months of physical therapy and you'll be back to work. Well, I was off 5 months.
Oh, my goodness.
Had two rounds of physical therapy.
Oh, no.
I've seen two different chiropractors for 3 months apiece. I've done acupuncture, the TENS unit. Everything but voodoo. So I don't, sometimes it's even caused problems on the other side, like the IT band and the lower back. And I think, you know, what is going on? And so practically speaking, with this surgery, how long till you're completely recovered? And is there 100% recovery with a total knee?
Well, let's just back up a minute here. And did you have like arthritic changes like that in your knee prior to this fall?
I never had any pain other than if I would climb like 3 flights of stairs, my knees would kind of burn and my quads. And I just thought my quads weren't very strong.
Sure.
Because the orthopedic surgeon did say, you can't blame it on the little grandson. I think you had some osteoarthritis going on. But, you know, there's good spacing between, you know, my right knee, my knee that's non-surgical. I have good spacing there. I work full-time. I'm 61 years old. I'm on my feet for work. So, I never really realized that I had anything going on, you know, till they tell you.
Okay.
Yeah. So how much time was there between your MCL repair and your total knee?
It was November. Then I met the second ortho doctor in March. So it was surgery was June 30th of a year ago.
Okay,
from November to June 30th.
Okay. So what are the issues now? Is it just pain? Do you have loss of mobility? Do you have swelling?
It's I never had a lot of swelling. It's stiffness and ache that'll kind of wake me up during the night. Stairs are difficult. Kneeling is difficult.
Yeah, well, you can't
kneel. I feel like the implant is, you know, I feel like it's a little too big. It feels wonky.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it was a very good surgeon, good reputation. I'm not blaming anybody, but I just feel like do you come back 100% from a total knee? Or, you know, sometimes after work and I'm going up my stairs at home, I feel like I feel like I'm pulling myself up a ladder instead
right,
of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Well,
right.
A little occasional achiness with prolonged activity, prolonged walking and standing is
yeah.
kind of to be expected,
yeah.
I would say. But this is out of that realm of what I would consider normal.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially
so,
with the battery of
right,
intervention she's
right,
had.
Right, right. I still wonder about the replacement. If you were not symptomatic beforehand, you know, it could have taken a while to recover from that MCL as well as the hairline patella fracture. Did they replace your patella at the time of your knee replacement?
No.
But you had that hairline fracture in it. Has that
That's
healed?
That was, yeah. And it actually healed itself by the time I had the MRI. And I thought, well, I knew there was some sort of a change, but it was just a train wreck. It just
yeah.
was very painful, and I was working 12-hour shifts on it
right.
with a brace and crying
yeah.
on my way home
yeah.
at night.
Right,
yeah.
right.
Well,
yeah.
So, I mean, it was rough. So I have a different job now, but it's still 4 8-hour shifts a week. I'm still on my feet, but it's carpeted. So
right.
I, you know, that is a huge
yeah.
difference. But I've been to foot and ankle. I've got the orthotics. I've
good.
Got the good
okay.
shoes.
Good. All right.
I have been doing, you know, massage. I've been doing everything that I can do to,
right.
you know, I'm just hoping that I will someday be 100% and be able to bound up the stairs like I used to.
Right. Yeah, I don't know that I'd go for the 100%. I'd maybe go for 90%.
Right.
Walk up the stairs, yes. Bound up the stairs, not so sure. There aren't a lot of people who bound up the stairs
well,
after any
replacement.
Well,
but it'd just be nice if she can walk up the stairs and not hurt.
Right, right.
I think just getting her through activities of daily living
right.
that are pain-free would
right.
be a reasonable
right.
thing.
Have you tried a pool?
No, I have not tried a pool.
Yeah, so that might be another option for you in terms of exercise where you don't have so much weight on your knee. So that would be one option for you. And if you need to get another opinion on your knee, I have seen at least one patient where her knee components were too large for her knee, and she had a revision.
Oh, really?
Okay. So I don't know that I would go that route. You're already
two
sort of reeling
in.
From two surgeries.
Two
I wouldn't
in.
Be real keen on jumping into another one, but it is something just to keep in the back of your mind.
Right, and I don't know if there's lots of trigger points in your muscles. I don't know if your physical therapist has tried dry needling at all.
Oh, yeah. That's the problem I've been having is, like, my IT band and my quads are very tight. My daughter's a massage therapist, and she says, yeah, they're very tight. And so sometimes I'll get the lower back pain and that trigger point where it feels like somebody kicked you in the side of the leg.
Right. Mm-hmm. So has a physical therapist dry needled that? Have you had dry needling done?
Not the dry needling. That I've done pressure point. I went to one who does a lot of muscle work and nerve work, and she would press in with her thumbs. And that pulled it like 30 seconds till the pain's relieved.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have an osteopathic college where I work, and they did some treatment too.
Okay. Well, I think you have a couple options yet, as I would maybe try the pool, and I'd maybe try and find a physical therapist in the Dubuque area that tries dry needling, because it sounds like the trigger points are a factor, and it sounds like maybe you're getting some short-term relief with that, and possibly dry needling could give you a little bit longer-term relief with the trigger points.
Yeah, something to think about.
Yeah.
Thank you,
yeah,
Sue, and good luck.
That's complicated. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very complicated. Wayne in Brown Deer has something for us. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, guests.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment about TMJ and TMJ syndrome and physical therapy. I was diagnosed with TMJ by my dentist, who did some work in my mouth and then finally referred me to a TMJ specialty group. And just prior to that, my wife was having some physical therapy done, and I went with her for a visit. And I mentioned that to her physical therapist, and he said they had a person in their group that had special training in TMJ.
I know who that person is.
Oh, yeah.
I do.
Well, I won't give her a name on the air, but she was wonderful.
Yep.
She diagnosed actually it being a C1-2 or high in the cervical area.
Yes, yep.
And within one session, my pain was dramatically reduced.
It's great.
And at the end of 3 or 4 sessions, it's been totally gone, and it's been about 9 months now, and I haven't had any recurrence. So it was something that I didn't think physical therapy would be applicable to, but it's certainly something that people can be aware of now.
Absolutely, and thanks for pointing that out. And kudos to your dentist for referring you to that's a great thing for a dentist to identify that and refer you to get some help for that. That's wonderful.
So that, again, just points to that, the importance of looking beyond just the primary joint. So he came in for TMJ, and typically your assessment would look at your jaw joint, look at your mouth, how it opens and closes, your occlusion. They'd measure different things. They'd palpate some of the muscles in your mouth. But she also looked beyond to look at the cervical spine and found that the origin of the pain was actually the cervical spine, and it was manifesting at TMJ.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. Amazing. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thanks for calling, Wayne. Cindy in Lake Mills, your turn. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling about my husband had a disc that was bulging, and all he was doing was guiding a piece of equipment. He wasn't lifting or pulling or nothing. And he went to several different doctors to get an opinion, and everybody wanted to do surgery on him. And he didn't want to do surgery. And a friend of his had sent him to a chiropractor, and I know everybody's boo-ha-bog against chiropractors, but this chiropractor was specialized in sports medicine. And he goes, well, I can alleviate probably 90% of your pain, but I can't make you pain-free. And when he had to sit down now. I mean, he was white as a sheet, and he wasn't sleeping in bed. He had to sleep on the floor with one leg up. And he started therapy with this chiropractor. And we were going to different chiropractors, and sometimes he felt worse than he did going in, coming out. But we went to this one chiropractor, and he was doing therapy before he even touched them. You know, he was doing different exercises, and then the chiropractor would adjust him and do different things with him. And after a couple of visits, he was feeling so much better and got the disc back where it was supposed to be and not bulging anymore. And this has been over 10 years ago, and he is fine. He didn't need any surgery. Like, everybody wanted to quick go in there and do surgery, and it's been absolutely fabulous. But he was a sports medicine doctor.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's great. I mean, as a profession, we don't boo-ha-ha any other medical professional. Everyone has a horse in this race. So we all bring a different perspective to it. So it's really fantastic that your husband got good relief. And I'm sure some of it had to do with the manipulation. Some of it had to do with the exercise. But what it really takes is a professional who's willing to look at that person,
right,
do a good evaluation, do a good assessment, and get the right intervention for them. So good for you guys for saying we're going to stay away from surgery and try some conservative measures first. And congratulations to you guys.
Right.
Yeah,
done. Cindy brings up a point. She said her husband wasn't lifting anything. Mm-hmm. He was just kind of guiding something along. Many times that is the case. It's the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's probably some low-grade issues going on all along, and then all of a sudden, one right movement, you end up in this situation.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you, Cindy.
Yep. Thanks for your call.
Judy and Racine, it's your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I have a groin injury, and I did go see a PT, but I think I probably waited too long. But anyway, we did stretching and weights and ultrasound, and I'm still having issues. I had 11 visits, and I'm wondering if you have any advice as far as exercises.
How did you hurt it in the first place?
Well, I have a rock garden, and it's on different levels, and I had my 2 feet on different levels, and I apparently hurt too far.
Yeah.
Well, that could be a primary groin problem. It could be an SI joint problem.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure with that. Were you bending over when you did this,
yeah,
Judy? So I'm not 100% sure. It's just adductor.
So, right. So causes of groin pain. A groin muscle strain, which is the low-hanging fruit. Thereafter, particularly in women, we think of primary hip problems. So in the low back, groin pain is sort of secondary. In a primary hip problem, groin will be one of your first sites of pain. So mm-hmm. it could be a primary hip problem. It could be that you just stirred things up in a marginally arthritic joint. It could be something called femoral acetabular impingement syndrome. It could be that you got caught up in some impingement in your hip that hasn't been addressed. You might need some hip mobilization. It could also be SI joint, which mm-hmm. refers to the groin. So
or a pubic lesion of some sort.
That went missed.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. either an up pube or down yeah. pube or something
yep.
like that.
Yep.
So there's other different things that are just other than exclusively soft tissue, which it sounds mm-hmm. like how they treated you initially.
Yeah. So if you've been treating as a primary groin strain and you're not getting better, someone needs to take a deeper look. Yeah. So if that physical therapist is not, providing what you need, then we kind of go back to Cindy, whose husband saw several different medical providers, several different chiropractors before they found one that was the right match, who took a good look at her husband. So you may need to find a different physical therapist
yeah.
If this person is yep. not meeting your needs.
Right. Yeah. You haven't turned the corner. It's
right. After 11 visits,
yep.
you should
yeah.
be getting better after
exactly.
11 visits.
Good luck, Judy. Thank you so much for calling. Gary in Waupaca emailed to ask how long it would take to see results from stretching exercises for tight hamstrings. And how often should he do these exercises?
Okay, well, that's a great question because he's assuming that the tightness he's feeling in the back of his leg is truly muscular and it's hamstring versus some impaired neuromobility. So if Gary's one of those people who feels like, I always stretch my hamstrings, I stretch and stretch and stretch and stretch and I don't see a change, I bet it's not his hamstring. I bet it's just kind of lack of mobility throughout his entire nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, if it is truly muscle tightness in his hamstrings, the older you are, the longer you need to hold that position because your tissues need to creep out. Your tissues have memory just like your head has memory, and the mm-hmm. older you are, the less memory they have. So, you know, if Gary were young and mature 50, mm-hmm. like me, I would be stretching for a good 45 seconds or so, and I'd be doing it frequently throughout the day, 6 to 8, 10 times per day.
Yep.
If he's younger, I would say you wouldn't have to hold the stretch quite as often.
So there are stretching has two different kinds of effects. One is we call the acute effects, and that's what you do before you go out for your run or whatever, and you stretch a little bit and it warms the muscle up. But when you're done, the muscle returns to its original length. Those are the acute effects of stretching. Then you have what are called the chronic effects of stretching, and those are when you're actually trying to lengthen the muscle. So you can add sarcomeres. Those are the little muscle cells. You can add them in series in your muscle, but it takes a prolonged stretch. So that means really holding it at least the 60 seconds and doing it frequently throughout the day so that your muscle says, oh, I'm supposed to be longer. Not I just need to be warmed up before I go for a run, but I need to be a longer muscle. And you have to do that many times, which means you need to figure out how to put that muscle on stretch during your day frequently.
Reva emailed to say that she's been diagnosed with top of foot arthritis. X-rays were done by a foot surgeon. Can you recommend a few good brands of over-the-counter shoe inserts, please?
Well, Superfeet is nice because they come in different levels and different support. So Superfeet is always a nice one. The colors are different. Arch mm-hmm. support, that's a good one to go with. And if you go to a running store or something like that, they'll help fit you, which is definitely, in her case, what I would mm-hmm. do. I would take my shoes with me, you know, explain the right. situation and have them kind of fit you with an off-the-shelf orthotic.
I use Sole. They're called S-O-L-E. I think you can only get them online, perhaps. Oh. So they come with a variety. They have sport. They have, you know, daily use, et cetera. So, but it's certainly wise to start with an off-the-shelf orthotic prior to getting a custom orthotics are relatively expensive, and certainly there are some people who need those. However, if you spend a lot of money in orthotic and you put it in your shoe and you realize that you can't stand to have something in your shoe, you've spent a lot of money. So, for example, I saw someone this morning who has some off the shelf, and some days they make her feet feel worse, and so she wears them some days and not. And we talked about strategies about that, but you'd be unhappy if you spent $300 and then discovered that you couldn't stand to have them in your shoes.
Right, and a lot of research shows that off-the-shelves are just as good as customs.
Yeah,
for the majority of the population.
Yeah,
and they cost
$30 to $50.
Yeah,
$30 to $50.
Yep.
Well, here we are. The music tells us it's time to close out. Lori and Jill, thank you so much.
Have a great Thanksgiving,
great
everybody.
Yep.
Get out for a walk.
Exactly. Or a run.
Or a run.
And dress appropriately.
Dress appropriately. Ba-bam.
You'll be back on December 18th, and we'll do it all over again.
Sounds great.
Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW's Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum is an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at the UW-Madison, and they'll be back on December 18th. Tomorrow, we will take a look at laser eye surgery with our guests, so I hope you'll join us for that. In the meantime, hey, stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.